Welcome to Modern Digital Applications, a podcast for corporate decision makers and executives looking to create or extend their digital business with the help of modern applications, processes, and software strategy. Now, welcome your host, a recognized industry thought leader in cloud computing and published author, bringing over 30 years of experience, Lee Acheson.
My guest today is Beth Long. Beth worked at New Relic, where she held roles in both engineering and marketing, including 2 years leading the reliability engineering team at New Relic. And that team owned the tooling and process for incident management and analysis. She also led New Relic's collaboration with the Snafu Catchers, which was a group of researchers that investigated how high-tech companies learn from past incidents. Beth recently left New Relic to join the startup Jelly.io, where she leads the engineering team working on the industry's first incident analysis platform. Beth, welcome to Modern Digital Applications.
Thank you, Lee. It is really great to be here.
Well, you and I worked together, you know, for several years. I'm trying to remember how many years we worked together.
We did. I think we overlapped for probably 4 years. I think we were both there the entire duration of my time at New Relic.
Yeah, it was an interesting place to work, and they had some very interesting problems. And you know, I was specifically impressed working with you on your focus on improvements after incidents occurred. And that seemed to be something that you really liked. You really liked to focus on, and honestly, it was something that really helped New Relic. So can you tell me a little bit about why looking at incidents after they occur is so important and why that's a focus of yours?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. Incidents is a bit of a weird obsession to have, but what I love about studying incidents so much is that they are this amazing opportunity to recalibrate our understanding of reality. And, you know, we those of us who work in tech at this point, we're all working on complex systems. I mean, when I started in web development in the early 2000s, you could get paid to make an HTML CSS site that, you know, ran on a server that was sitting in someone's closet somewhere. And now even the most basic website has a...
I had one of those servers.
Right?
I mean, sitting in a closet somewhere, Make sure the dial-up connection doesn't break.
Exactly. You know? I mean, in those days, like, there were a lot of systems that you could hold a reasonably accurate map of the whole thing in your head. And today, that's just not possible. The complexity has grown so much that even in an entire organization of people who have different perspectives on a system, their perspectives on what's working and why and how are always drifting away from reality. They're always incomplete. And the more complex the system, the faster and farther that understanding drifts. And so even though we can never completely have an up-to-date and complete view of a complex system, an incident kind of acts as almost a dowsing rod that kind of shows us, okay, here's the place that we need to pay attention. Here's the place where our understanding of how things are working is acutely wrong and where we really need to recalibrate. And so, unfortunately, most of us see incidents as something that we need to entirely stamp out, that they're this enemy, but we can actually flip that perspective and start to look at them as an uncomfortable but very important ally to help us really understand what it is about our systems that is escaping us and start to recalibrate in a useful way.
So analyzing incidents is really all about and understanding how the system works and figuring out how it really works, not how we think it works.
Exactly. And one thing that's important to understand in when we say how the system works is to understand that the system encompasses more than just the software and the infrastructure. It actually encompasses the people, the team structure, the organizational boundaries. And so one thing we often don't pay close enough attention to is all of those human elements that are so important in operating modern web systems.
Yeah, that's such an important point. I think it's often overlooked is the operation of a software system is not just the software. It's not just the operational components. It's the people that manage it. It's the people that maintain deployments. It's the management of the people that manage it. And it's a complex system that involves humans, not just software.
Exactly.
That's actually really, you know, taking a step back, that's actually what we're talking about here when we talk about looking at incidents. We're talking about the post-incident analysis, about figuring out what happened during the incident that caused it and how we responded to it. Not necessarily the actual process that we go through in analyzing it and fixing it and resolving it, but afterwards looking at how that process went. What caused the problem? How did we detect the problem? How the people responded to it, how they communicated with each other, how they interacted, how they brainstormed solutions, and then how they finally rolled out the solutions, and how well those solutions were received, as well as what customers were impacted and how much were they impacted and all those sorts of things. So it's the after effects that we're looking at here. So from your experience, what's the number one thing that people who don't yet look at incidents in retrospective like that, what should they start doing?
Oh, I love this question. The standard response to that question, I think, would probably be twofold. It would be, well, you should start doing incident retrospectives or postmortems, whatever you want to call it. You should do some kind of report after the incident happens, and you should identify and address the follow-up actions that come out of that report. And that's kind of the template that the industry is following right now. And while that's not a wrong answer, it's not a very helpful one if you're not already doing that process. And the way that most people are doing those actions, we tend to waste a lot of opportunity. So if I were talking to an engineering organization that doesn't already have a process in place for post-incident analysis, for an incident post-mortem process, I would be excited because they would have an opportunity to do this a little bit differently and equip a small group of folks that are very interested in investigating incidents. They don't all have to be engineers even. They can be people who are in the organization who are interested in seeing improvement across the organization as a result of learning from incidents. And I would equip that small group of people to investigate incidents that are interesting. One thing we tend to do is you have to investigate every single incident.
Yeah, it's the incident ended. We need to investigate it now. It's that mindset often exists.
Exactly. And then you kind of invent a process and it becomes just paperwork and you end up not getting a lot of value out of it. And so I might have an engineering group say, we're going to start by looking at interesting incidents. What are interesting incidents? They're incidents that surprised us. They're incidents where people were what Morgan Collins at Salesforce calls in the mud. Like things were happening and obviously there was a problem, but everybody was perplexed and it took a long time for us to figure out what was going on. An incident that people say, we keep having the same incident over and over again. Why do we keep doing the same thing? Incidents that cross boundaries, they cross team boundaries or system boundaries and involve a lot of different parts of the organization. These are the kinds of incidents that tend to have a lot of interesting insights into both the technical and human side of how the engineering organization is operating. And if you can equip a group of folks that are willing and able to have conversations with the people that participated in the incident and understand, why did you make the decisions you made? What led you to make those decisions? And start to unpack the thinking process without, there's this phrase we use a lot, hindsight is 20/20, which is really not true. Hindsight imposes all kinds of assumptions and, kind of makes all of these guesses about why and how things happened that overemphasize what you know after the fact and don't consider well enough what it was to that led people to make those decisions in the first place. So I think that's what I would suggest to a group that has a clean slate, because if they practice this kind of approach, they would start to get deeper insights into what's happening rather than kind of creating this postmortem machinery that just becomes, you know, another item on your checklist that you have to do so you don't get in trouble with your boss.
So one of the things you said that I really liked was you talked about in the definition of what an interesting incident was, one of the things you chose was incidents that surprised us. And a lot of people say, well, don't all incidents surprise you? And the fact of the matter is, no, they don't. You know, the, you know, there's, you know, certainly what I find is a lot of incidents that occur were fully expected, fully, even sometimes fully planned for, but that is another whole discussion there, but certainly fully expected. And in fact, they occur over and over and over again. And that's a, it's a whole different class of problem that occurs there. But incidents that surprise you are really the scary ones, because it's, you know, the unknown unknowns, according to Rumsfeld, are really the ones that can be the most scary, because they you have no idea what's going to happen. You have no idea what's going on. And so choosing that as a specific subclass of incidents really kind of puts light under the fact that there's a large number of things that really matter here that kind of go outside of our control.
Absolutely. You've honed in on one of my favorite topics here. I think surprising incidents are the most interesting, the most important. And Ed Catmull at Pixar actually talks a lot about how to identify small crises early, because he talks about how success hides failure. You know, companies that are successful are concealing a series of small failures that don't become an existential threat until all of a sudden they do. And we see the same thing in the technology space. We have an opportunity to look at surprises when they're relatively small and say, how did this take us by surprise? How did, I'm trying to think of a good specific example, but the kinds of things that are interesting surprises are when you go to restore your backups and the backups aren't there. When you go to, here's a great example of a really surprising incident. A very minor bug in a front-end section of the JavaScript that triggers a cascade that ends up taking down the entire accounting system on the last day of the quarter when everybody's trying to close their accounts.
Which is, of course, the time that the accounting system will go down, because it's the time it's the most used.
Exactly. And there are a lot of interesting surprises in sort of nested in that kind of incident, where there's the surprise of the technical chain reaction and not understanding the hidden dependencies in a system. There's the surprise of engineers not thinking in terms of a quarterly calendar and taking a very long time to understand the severity of this because they're not thinking about the impact on the accounting group. All kinds of interesting things there that are latent in the system, and incidents are what surface those surprises and let you see, oh, we're not even thinking about these things. These are the unknown unknowns. These are the things that we haven't even imagined.
So the interesting thing you said there, which I wholeheartedly agree with, is the surprises, the incident itself might not even be the surprise, but while you're dealing with the incident, the plans you have for dealing with expected or at least not surprising incidents might in fact generate surprises. I think that's a great analogy. In my book, you know, which I talk about risk management a lot in the book, I use this story, and I'll relate it here for the podcast too. And I'd love to get your perspective on it. we rented an apartment and it had a garage, which was really neat, but it was completely detached from everything. And it was in a separate building. And the only door it had was the main garage door, which had a garage door opener on it. So take that data point and just set it there for a second. Now, the other data point was we tended to have brownouts and power outages in this apartment complex a lot. So one of the things we did was we bought a generator to provide power to our house for the periods of time when we had brownouts. Well, where are we going to put the generator? Well, we can't put it in a house, so we'll put it in a garage. Now, I think you see already what happened. First time the power outage existed, and guess what? There was no manual lever to disconnect the garage door opener from the power garage door opener. So the generator, which was our risk management system and for contingency for when the incident of the power going off occurred, was ready, willing, and worked just fine. We just couldn't get to it. You know, the cascading failures of little things you don't think about that may not even be failures. I mean, it wasn't a failure that the garage door didn't have a manual override. It was just a shortcoming. But that shortcoming, combined with all these other things occurring in a row, led to a complete and total system failure. Now, I'm sure you can imagine, or you've gone through many, many, many real life incidents that fit that sort of a pattern. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, you know, maybe one that comes to mind.
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind is you're really pointing at a flaw in one of the models that we use a lot in the industry, which is the idea that we need to get down to the root cause of an incident.
Root cause analysis.
Root cause analysis, and there's the five whys, and there's all these approaches to saying, okay, we're going to get down to the root of this issue. And I like to think the only way that this analogy works for me is if you think about a tree and its root system, and you think about roots as these, as this network of intertwined things, you know, reaching out into the ground. Like, that's what root cause really is, because there's not in any system of any interesting complexity, there is very rarely a single thing that you can boil a problem down to. And so this is a great example, because like, what was the root cause of the incident you just described? Was it the power going out? Was it the, you know, forgetting about this dependency? There were all of these contributing factors that overlaid on top of each other.
The root cause didn't matter.
And it didn't matter.
Combination of all these things that happened.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you mentioned five whys. So do you want to talk about that a little bit? So I'm sure there's people who are listening in who don't know what the five whys are and how, and frankly, what's wrong with the five whys.
So the five whys is a model that tries to, it's a very well-intentioned approach that's trying to get people to kind of think more deeply about what went wrong in an incident. But it has its shortcomings that we'll talk about. So what are the five whys? The five whys are, we had an incident. And actually, I'm going to use an example that I'd like to invite you to riff on a little bit, because you've written about this. The infamous S3 outage that happened a few years back. So you could come at this event, okay, the five whys. Why did S3 go down? Well, it went down because someone typed the wrong command at the command line. Well, why did they type the wrong command at the command line? And you kind of go down and you ask why, answer the question, ask why again, and you do that several times, you know, five times or sort of until you quote unquote run out of insight. And this can be a useful exercise, but it tends to narrow your focus to one line of thinking and to one line of investigation. And it often prevents you from following those multiple routes out and understanding all of those different paths those contributing factors that overlaid at different points in time and in different ways to yield the ultimate problem or set of problems, because most incidents aren't, you know, a problem. They are multiple things that need to be investigated and resolved. So I would be curious if you would like to talk just a little bit about that S3 outage, because I know you've written about it.
Yeah. So the S3 outage that Beth is talking about, I'll put a link to an article that I wrote up about it and a link to the original AWS report that talked about it as well, too. I'll put those links in the show notes. But the outage was a few years ago, maybe 3-4 years ago. And what happened was, S3 as a service went down. Now, the world today runs on S3. There's very few systems, very few computer systems in the world that don't have some sort of dependency on S3 nowadays. So that was a major outage for many, 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 many companies and major impact on the internet in general. What happened? Well, the colloquial story that the press told was that somebody fat-fingered a command. Imagine being that person that, okay, you're the one that brought down the internet that day. And I'm sure that person, and I don't even know if they published a person's name, I doubt it, and I hope I certainly would never repeat it, even if I knew who it was. But that person, I'm sure, felt really bad about what they did. But fact of the matter is, that wasn't the problem. The problem wasn't even really a major problem. It actually was, in my mind, a demonstration of AWS doing all the right things at the right time. Because the problem with large, complex systems, when you have humans involved in them, is humans make mistakes. In this case, the fat finger was, he ended up bringing down, I think, some number of servers. It wasn't very many, but it was like 2 or 3 or maybe even 10, I don't know, out of tens of thousands of servers. I don't remember what the number was, but what happened is it caused an unexpected cascade of problems to occur. S3 is designed to self-heal. And those self-heal algorithms kind of fell on top of each other. And ultimately what happened was massive numbers of servers started having problems and the system went down. If you were involved with the incident and heard my description, you're gonna say, no, that's too simplistic. But it's a good description of what happened at this level of conversation anyway. So a real simple thing that was very benign, oops, and the system went down. Well, the problem is most companies actually do that. They have humans involved in the process of making decisions about how the operations work, and humans make mistakes, and that's where a lot of incidents happen. But good companies, or companies who think this problem through, don't even give humans access to the operations environment. They give tools to the humans, and the tools are the ones that actually do the work. For example, don't give humans super user access to your servers, because what do they need super user access for? What do they need to reboot the computers? That command requires super user. Well, that's fine, but super user gives you a whole lot more power than just rebooting a computer. Rather than giving them super user command, build a tool that allows someone with much less permission the ability to click a button and reboot the computer. And guess what? The computer reboots and everything is much better. Create tooling to put a level of shield between you and the operation of the system. The tooling allows you to filter the commands, to approve the commands, to log the commands, to give history of the commands for post-incident analysis, and they give you the opportunity to correct mistakes. Tooling is great. And guess what? That's exactly what AWS did. AWS has all that tooling in place and was using it. And what happened in this particular case is there was a bug in the tooling. The tooling just didn't think about catching this one particular type of mistake that this one particular type of person happened to make on that particular day. Those things happen. It was a minor incident, a minor problem, easily corrected, and it has been corrected, so that sort of incident would never occur again. But the media treated this whole thing like it was a human made a mistake, and how could you build a system like this, and how could it be so unstable that humans are involved and all that sort of stuff? And no, it wasn't a fat finger issue at all. It was a minor bug in a minor piece of tooling, and everything else they did was a best practice of making things better. So I love to talk about that as an example of how you build best practices. even though it was a massive outage, the result of that outage was this methodology became much more visible, and hopefully a lot more companies started taking that into account.
That is such a beautiful summary of that event, and I love how you unpack it, because it makes crystal clear one of my favorite things to talk about, which is when we in the industry try to offload blame for an incident to human error, which you and I have both talked about how much we hate this notion of human error, because it's sort of hiding the complexity of the system in the supposed fallibility of humans. And really, when humans make quote unquote mistakes, humans do tend to flub certain kinds of things. We're not always the greatest at precision. We're not terribly good at high speed repetition, the way that computers are. Our weakness is also our strength, because we're very adaptable. And you talked about the decisions that humans need to make. Tooling can't make decisions. It can only follow a very rigid set of algorithmic decision process. Humans are able to look at, back to our earlier conversation, a surprising event and say, oh, I wasn't expecting that. Let me adapt. Let me figure out a different solution to this problem. Let me do something that's not in the run book, but that might solve this problem. And so the interplay between humans and tooling is a fascinating one, and one that I'd love to see the industry continue to get more savvy about, because the trick is finding tooling that helps us prevent those mistakes, repetition problems, imprecision problems, while still giving humans the visibility and the control that when things are surprising, they can still adapt and they're not locked into a downward spiral. And the ultimate cautionary tale for this is the issue with the Boeing 737. Is it 737?
737 MAX.
Yeah. That was a case of tooling that was not adaptable, that was forcing a very complex and critical system into a failure mode that the humans had no ability to disrupt or adapt or get out of, and with tragic results.
Right.
And so often our results aren't that obviously tragic, but so many of our systems are mission critical to the operation of modern society, and we really need to be taking these tooling decisions seriously.
So, you're absolutely hit on right. You know, it's the ideal situation is you let humans make decisions, you let toolings implement decisions, because toolings are good at doing things. Computers are good at doing things. They're not good at deciding on things, but humans aren't very good at doing things, but they are very good at deciding on what needs to be done. So that's kind of, I think, the way I like to summarize it too, is that tooling helps you do the things that humans aren't good at in a much better way. Now, interesting you bring up the 737 MAX. That's probably another whole podcast episode right there that we could talk about. And maybe we can come back and we can do another one on that. But let's keep that in reserve, but I definitely am interested in that one, yeah. Maybe do a little bit more research and then come back and do an episode on that. Join me next time for part two of my interview with Beth Long as we continue our discussion about incident analysis, and we talk about the new incident analysis platform, Jelly.io, that Beth is currently working on.
Jelly.io is a new platform that it's currently in closed beta. We just finished out a preliminary design partnership with Indeed.com, and they're beginning to use this now, which allows you to import the Slack transcript of the incident response into our platform and correlate PagerDuty alert data. You're able to have an investigator go in and tag the conversation. And so we allow investigators to create actually multiple timelines of different narratives through the course of the incident.
Coming up on the next episode of Modern Digital Applications.
Thank you for listening to Modern Digital Applications with Lee Acheson. Lee helps executives keep up with industry trends and best practices in cloud computing, application scaling, DevOps, and applications modernization in order to stay in front of disruptive influencers. Subscribe to this podcast to ensure you get each new episode as it's available. Visit mdacast.com for all the resources and publications from Lee and his team. Thank you for tuning in to today's show.